702. SMS Karima on 31702.
25 minutes after 9 o'clock. Now, most of us heard earlier today that the Reserve Bank has kept the repo rate unchanged at 6.75%. This is in line with the expectations of most economists and analysts. The governor of the Reserve Bank, Mr. Lesetša Ganyago, announced the benchmark rate call at a media briefing in Pretoria today. He stated that the decision was unanimous. The reason is important to us because changes in the repo rate affect prime lending rates, which of course is the rate at which banks use as a starting point to calculate interest rates for their clients. So tonight we are joined by Dr. Azar Jameen, the chief economist at Econometrics, to provide us with some context and to let us know if all of these non-changes of the repo rate will impact on our pockets. We will also, of course, discuss the matter in the context of the policy positions of the ANC contained in its manifesto, and also the remarks by the president and Mr. Ganyago about the independence of the bank. But before we speak to Dr. Jameen, let's just listen to the governor announce the fact that the rate remains unchanged.
Against this backdrop, the MPC unanimously decided to keep the repurchase rate unchanged at 6.75%. The committee continues to assess the stance of monetary policy to be broadly accommodative.
That is, of course, the Reserve Bank governor there, Mr. Lesetša Ganyago, speaking earlier today. Dr. Azar Jameen, welcome to the program.
Good evening, Karima, and good evening to your listeners.
Now, lots of you were saying that this is probably what he is going to do. But whilst this was a standard meeting of the Monetary Policy Committee, there was a brouhaha that broke out after the release of the ANC manifesto, which, of course, has in it the fact that whilst the bank must look at inflation targeting, it also has to adopt a flexible approach. It has to look at other issues, developmental concerns, things like unemployment and so on. And there's been different things being said by different people in the governing party. Do you think the markets read the unchanged rate today as what the bank would have done irrespective of what was in the manifesto? Or do you think that they believe that the committee might have come under some kind of pressure?
Undoubtedly, the markets have not had any fear that the Reserve Bank would succumb to populist pressures to do what they would like to see. There are very strong fundamental reasons why the Reserve Bank kept interest rates unchanged. Most importantly, it now sees inflation turning out to be lower than previously anticipated. Mm. In fact, the criticism that one might level is that the bank did not leave the repo rate unchanged back in November, because already then many of the forces that it cited as leaving, compelling it to leave to hike interest rates had already started being reversed at that time. Oil prices were already tumbling in November. The rand was already strengthening. There's one thing that has changed in the interim, and that is that the United States, in November, it was feared that they would have to raise interest rates four times next year. That has now been revised. The stock market correction that was quite severe over Christmas compelled the authorities in the U.S. to say, no, actually, I think two interest rate hikes next year might be enough. And that has relieved a lot of the pressure on the rand and on the Reserve Bank still further not to increase our own interest rates here.
Absolutely. And that segues nicely into the clip quickly. Let's take a listen to the governor speaking about headline inflation.
Headline inflation is now expected to average 4.6% in 2018 and 4.8% in 2019, before increasing to 5.3% in 2020 and moderating to 4.8% in 2021.
Dr. Jameen, do you agree with his forecast?
Yeah, very much so at the moment. One can't be sure about that. Forecasts are forecasts, and they depend on underlying trends. But the most fundamental change that's taken place is that they are now they have downgraded their forecast for the oil price for the next few years from 73 to around $62 to $65 a barrel. Now that makes a tremendous difference if you translate it into what that means for the petrol price. Effectively, it means that the petrol price will be around 1.50 rand per litre lower in their forecast for the next few years than it was previously. And that translates in turn into a reduction in inflation of, for next year, their inflation forecast has been revised down by 0.7%. That's huge.
Yes.
From 5.3 down to 4.6. That's a huge reduction. Yeah.
Now, of course,
and I agree with it.
We of course know that, markets are not an exact science, neither is economics. It's often influenced by sentiment. The kind of toing and froing around the Reserve Bank's independence and its mandate, reiterated by the president on the eve of Brand South Africa getting ready to go to Davos, reiterated by Tito Mboweni, the finance minister, Enoch Godongwana, but slated by the alliance partners. And of course, if you look in the manifesto itself, the manifesto is actually very clear. I think it's on page 35 or something. I actually am walking around with the manifesto in my bag, where it speaks to the fact that it actually does need to have a more flexible approach to the repo rate. And there's been a historical battle in the African National Congress about this. This is now way before the supposed radical economic transformation people made their way onto the kind of stage. Historically, both COSATU and the South African Communist Party have argued for a more flexible approach. I have found my manifesto, and I want to read out what it says. It says, our macroeconomic framework, including fiscal and monetary policies, will be aligned to support the commitments made in this manifesto. The ANC believes that the South African Reserve Bank must pursue a flexible monetary policy regime aligned with the objectives of the second phase of the transition. Without sacrificing price stability, monetary policy must take into account other objectives such as employment creation and economic growth. Some might say that this is a contradiction in terms. Others, like the finance minister, has said that this is what the bank has always done.
Well, not only the finance minister, the Reserve Bank governor himself said the bank has frequently said, read through all the MPC statements made over the past decade, and you'll find a myriad number of references to the fact that the bank is pursuing a flexible monetary policy.
Mm-hmm. So do you think, Dr. Jameen, that this is a straw argument, that people are kind of haggling over words, that the bank's independence is not at stake? We know that one of the deputy governors is going, and a new person is going to likely be replaced. Governor didn't want to really be drawn on that much today. But there is concern in some circles, certainly in business, that this uncertainty needs to kind of be straightened out. Now, I don't know how more certain it gets if the president, the Reserve Bank governor, and the Minister of Finance tells you the same thing, and the head of the Economic Transformation Committee. But you also can't run away from the wording of this, and that some might read into it an attempt to redefine the mandate. And of course, the governor reminded us today that that would require a constitutional change.
Absolutely. I think one must bear in mind that you can't just suddenly decide to, he said, you can't have new law in Parliament to change the mandate of the Reserve Bank. You actually have to change the constitution completely.
Yeah.
So you're not going to sacrifice the... He also went out of his way to show that there are other central banks in the world,
yes,
where the government owns them, and yet they're very independent. And
absolutely. I mean, a lot of the OECD countries have nationalized central banks, but they perform an independent function. And that was certainly the sense that one got after the ANC NASDAQ conference, although they had argued that the bank be nationalized, that is a different question from who decides on the mandate and the bank's independence, and the two shouldn't be conflated.
Absolutely. I think what markets will remain afraid of is that there is an underlying desire on the part of populist elements,
yes,
to try and bring about a situation where interest rates are lower than they ought to be, as a means of trying to spur growth in the,
yes,
hope that that will create more jobs.
Yeah.
But that's a very short-term approach. It can work for a short period of time, but before you know it, you're in a Zimbabwean or Venezuelan type situation.
But I mean, if one looks at the U.S. economy, if we look at some of the other economies, because I had Kusatu and the South African Communist Party on to argue their case, because they argue for this flexibility. And they're saying that globally the trend is different, that we are out of step, actually. There is actually a lowering. It is part of the toolkit to try and stimulate growth, to try and get some movement in the economy, and that the Communist Party makes the point that the Constitution speaks about substantial growth that must be ensured, that the Reserve Bank's responsibility is that. And they argue that substantial growth has never been part of democratic South Africa. And even at a time when you had 7% growth, a lot of it was jobless. And so they believe that they are completely within their rights and completely within the constitutional framework of insisting that the bank take note of the development challenges in the economy when they make these decisions.
I think the bank is is undoubtedly aware of these issues, but its philosophy is that they don't compare us with the developed economies,
yes,
where structurally they are on a much sounder footing than we are. We have major structural impediments, and that there is no point in trying to use interest rates as a vehicle to generate higher growth when you have insufficiently developed outcomes in education, when you have corruption and state capture, when you have state-owned enterprises that are not being effectively run, when you have monopoly capital that dominates the economy and small business is not allowed to thrive properly, when you have such high levels of inequality in such circumstances you could be on a hiding second to none to try and stimulate the economy by using interest rates rather than trying to address the more fundamental impediments to employment creation.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they have a point there.
Dr. Jameen, one of the interesting questions that was asked today at that briefing was also that there was a meeting between the Zimbabweans and South Africans in terms of Reserve Bank governance. Now, we know that there's a complete shutdown in Zimbabwe. There's a currency crisis. Some economists have said that we actually need to assist Zimbabwe because Zimbabwe's problems inevitably affects us. The governor didn't want to be drawn on it and said that the responsible political authorities will speak to that matter. But from an economic point of view, if one looks at the foreign currency crisis in Zimbabwe, the fact that Emmerson Mnangagwa is sitting in Russia trying to bring some of that currency home, he released a statement via Twitter, ironically, while switching off his whole country from the internet, and also saying he's not coming home anytime soon. What do you think ought to be our responsibility and approach to the Zimbabwean economy? Should we assist them with foreign currency?
I think that in the short term, it would be very helpful to assist them with foreign currency. Otherwise, we run the risk of losing a lot of business ourselves.
Yes.
It could be to our benefit to try and be as magnanimous as we possibly can. But we've also got to be very careful lest Zimbabweans suddenly start realizing that they're becoming the 10th province of South Africa.
Yes, I mean, we spoke with Peter Thornycroft, who's a veteran Zimbabwean journalist, and we also spoke with Professor Brian Raftopoulos last night. There are no internal flights in Zimbabwe because the fuel is just so expensive. You can't buy a cool drink in downtown Harare. And obviously we know for a long time that we've been carrying the can for flights to Zimbabwe, that Air Zimbabwe itself is essentially basically bankrupt. So in many ways, we are already incurring costs, even if we haven't made a formal decision to do so.
Yeah, without a doubt, we are doing so. But I think that We are extremely concerned that a total implosion of Zimbabwe would not only result in an important source of South African exports disappearing, but also runs the risk of a massive humanitarian crisis that would affect us, with Zimbabweans in their hundreds of thousands then wanting to flee across the border, across the Limpopo.
Absolutely. And I mean, some of them are already coming over just to buy petrol because it's cheaper here. I mean, I saw on the television today some of ENCA reporters at border posts talking to Zimbabweans who are just close to those border towns. And, of course, they also add to the economy of a lot of our border towns, just buying up petrol because it's cheaper. But, again, all of these arrangements could lead to greater problems. You could have people running schemes like they did in places like Nigeria and so on. And it would be better if a formal economic response from South Africa is actually worked out vis-a-vis Zimbabwe, won't it?
Yes, I do. I do believe so. And of course, you know, the roots of this problem go back nearly 20 years.
Yes.
And President Mbeki carried a lot of criticism at the time for not stepping in to stop Zimbabwe doing precisely what some of parties in South Africa are calling for South Africans to start adopting, without realizing that South Africa would end up the same way as Zimbabwe if we were to pursue those policies.
Mm-hmm.
So someone as insightful as President Ramaphosa, I think there is a role for him to try and alleviate the situation somehow.
So if you were to be whispering into the president's ear, if you were to be called into a meeting to say, Dr. Dlamini, we're sitting with this crisis in Zimbabwe. They have no foreign currency. Half of the population probably lives in South Africa. They come into our border towns anyway. What is it economically that we can do to assist the Zimbabwean economy without getting ourselves into trouble? What would you tell him? What would you tell the president?
Well, first of all, he would need to try and explain to his counterparty that they need to start controlling their expenditure as a government and start opening up the Zimbabwean economy to the people more readily than has been the case at the moment, where the government has been in Zimbabwe for many years under Mugabe, and it doesn't seem to have changed too much, is still controlling everything rather than allowing the private sector and even the working class to actually have a say in what is happening. And the other thing is, I think in the short term, South Africa can step in to assist financially,
mm-hmm.
but it would need to do so with very stringent conditions.
Yes.
And that is, I don't think that our ANC politicians are prepared to impose those stringent conditions onto Zimbabwean politicians for whatever the reason is.
You know, I'm watching the SABC television and I'm watching President Ramaphosa in Ethiopia. And of course, he went to Mozambique first and he's at the AU. And I'm sure discussions around Zimbabwe will happen on the sidelines there. We also have the crisis in the DRC, as we know, with those elections, people still demanding a recount. The plate is quite full, but we want to increase intra-Africa trade. Zimbabwe is one of our important trading partners. We do have to have a SADC approach at an economic level as well. I mean, we can't have South Africa in a sea of underperforming economies, can we?
We can't have South Africa, but South Africa is the foremost underperforming economy.
Exactly.
There. And it's very sad to reflect on the fact that other regions on the continent, most notably East Africa and parts of West Africa, are really booming at the moment, notwithstanding political instability in some instances, even Kenya.
Yes.
People are saying, wow, look at Kenya. But the fact is the economy is booming. It's growing at 5% or more per annum, notwithstanding terrorist activities, because they are allowing the free market to run far more effectively than is the case with Zimbabwe or even South Africa.
The situation in Nigeria is obviously also quite important to us. We are often pit against Nigeria as if, you know, there is this kind of fake competition. And of course, one is not comparing apples with apples when we compare the two economies, because the base is very different. South Africa is a much more diversified economy. And we've seen how Nigeria's economy ground to a halt, you know, around the oil crisis. But there's a lot riding on stability within the continent, also for South Africa. I mean, we have quite a lot of elections that are happening on the continent, and there is, of course, a lot of economic development that has also happened through our infrastructure development programs. How important is a stable Africa for South Africa's currency as well, and just for South African exports in general?
I think it is very important, and I think South Africa, in a way, has benefited over the past decade. The domestic economy would have done a lot worse still had it not been for the fact that many African economies were actually growing much faster than the South African economy. It provided a valve mechanism for many of our companies to survive through activities in the rest of the continent. Some of them obviously got into trouble, like Tiger Brands in Nigeria and the like. But a lot of them, especially our construction companies, that was a lifeline to them to actually deal with other African countries and to invest in them. I suppose to the extent that stability and economic progress go together, I think it's very important for South Africa. And a few years ago, the portents were looking extremely positive. And they are still positive, as I suggested, in some of the regions of Africa. And unfortunately, those are now starting to prove competitive to Southern Africa and Nigeria, and are pulling away a lot of the investment that would otherwise have come to us and our surrounding regions, rather than the going to East Africa and North Africa and Senegal and Cote d'Ivoire, who are growing at 8-9% per annum.
Absolutely. We have to pull up our socks. We have to, of course, also look at the developments in the European Union, given that as a bloc, it remains our largest trading partner. We saw Theresa May surviving a vote of no confidence, but she has to go back to the drawing board to come up in 2 days what she had 2 years to come up with, which is a new Brexit plan. How does it impact on us? Some people saying that, you know, notwithstanding our relationships with the EU, our trade relations with Britain is actually sound. Her visit here was an attempt to kind of solidify the relationships when they're outside of the Union. What is the impact on South Africa regarding the Brexit deal and the constant delays and the inability of the British government to actually put a deal on the table that's acceptable to the European counterparts and even their own parties within Great Britain?
You know, it's a very mixed scenario. On the one hand, there is no doubt, there is total unanimity that Brexit would be bad for British economic growth. Depending on what kind of deal is reached or whether there is no deal, a Brexit is estimated to potentially entail a a diminution in British growth of between 2 and 5% over the next 5 years overall, which is, you know, when within the context of 1 and 2% growth rates, that's quite material.
Yeah.
And Europe also stands to suffer. And to the extent that South Africa depends on being able to export to these regions, that effect is negative. But then on the positive side, a more isolated Britain would start looking far more to its traditional markets start doing business with. And South Africa stands to benefit. I've actually spoken to a number of British, local British diplomats who say that is their objective, to regenerate trade ties. I mean, it's pathetic that with the kind of colonial heritage, that legacy that we've had between Britain and South Africa, that Britain is our ninth largest trading partner, only the ninth. And also bearing in mind that Britain is, well, historically the largest foreign direct investor in South Africa. And South Africa was the third largest destination, highest destination for British manufacturing companies. So I am hopeful that in the event that Brexit takes place, you could start seeing Britain rising and South Africa taking advantage of the closer ties that we can benefit from an inter transfer of skills. I mean, so many of our students benefit from studying, I myself included, having studied in Britain. I think there's enormous scope that can counterbalance the decline in export performance due to lower overall macroeconomic growth in Europe and Britain resulting from Brexit. So I'm not entirely as negative as some people are about Brexit's impact on South Africa specifically.
Well, Dr. Jamin, on that positive note, we will end this interview. Thank you so very much for participating. That is the Director and Chief Economist at Econometrics, Dr. Azar Jamin, speaking to us about the repo rate, but also within the context of an ANC policy debate on the mandate of the bank, and then also, of course, the developments on the continent and the developments in the EU, all of which has an impact on the way in which our economy performs. Now, it's just gone 12 minutes before 10 o'clock.